This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of September 25th, 2022. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 257. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. And, on the big deal feature, another installment of MMA, Mackin, Mario, and Andy. Mario Canseco of Research Co. and Andy Yan of the Simon Fraser University City Program join me to look back at the week that was on the road to the October 15th local elections. Is it just me, or is Canadian law professor Richard McLaren an unsung hero in the world of sport, which continues to grapple with corruption, doping, and abuse scandals? McLaren is best known for investigating Russia's state-sponsored doping, international weightlifting corruption, and boxing match-fixing at Rio 2016. He recently investigated the abuse of women who played under the guilty Bob Berarda for the Canadian women's team and the Whitecaps. The Declan Hill-led University of New Haven Sports Integrity Center named McLaren the first Nobel Purpose Sports Integrity Award winner on September 22nd. Basketball's Enes Kanter Freedom and tennis's Peng Shuai were the runners-up. Here is a clip from Richard McLaren's acceptance speech.
My work has involved investigating major international federations and bringing about an accountability framework. My hope is that it can lead to more integrity in governance through independent oversight and accountability. But this all needs to be framed within a culture that accepts change, understands the problem, and most importantly, is willing to fix it. In terms of looking at the culture of sport and sporting organizations, there is still much that needs to be done. Setting up codes of conduct, rules of ethics, independent reviews of these policies is one way. However, the rules and regulations are only as good as the people who oversee them and administer them. It's the vigilance and oversight throughout all the layers of athletes and sport organizations and involvement that will start the changes that are necessary and imperative to ensure that our athletes of the future can compete and know that it's their best efforts that make them winners. And nothing will truly change if those who witness wrongdoings don't speak out and are believed. My view is that we are at a crossroads in sport integrity, and I'm confident that sport will take the right path, and many people are working towards a rebalancing of how sport operates.
That was Canadian law professor Richard McLaren accepting the first Nobel Purpose Sports Integrity Award on September 22nd from the University of New Haven Sports Integrity Center. What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news. This is the big deal feature on the Breaker.news podcast. It's MMA time again. Mackin, Mario, and Andy. Mario Canseco of Research Co. and Andy Yan of the Simon Fraser University City Program join me to keep an eye on the road to local election day on October 15th. In Vancouver, housing remains the number one issue. Housing scarcity, housing affordability, housing styles, how neighborhoods should be. Four of the main parties running candidates for a mayor are promoting variations on the higher density and build, build, build theme. Colleen Hardwick and Team for a Livable Vancouver, they are the outliers. They want to slow down.
Is Team the smartest in the room? Does Team know something that the others don't?
I think that what they realize is the fact that Vancouver's at a different stage of where it was, say, 20 years ago. That I think that it's really at a stage through which we are in a state of redevelopment, as opposed to having large plots of land that are ready for, you know, new buildings. That I think that it's part of the realization is the changes that Vancouver will see into the future is actually one of incremental change that really, with save for a few large blocks, which I think people are talking about in terms of, you know, what's going to happen in Jericho or the Heatherlands, or really and Sanok, that really there aren't too many large parcels of real estate that are available in for development in the city of Vancouver. And very much it's really almost a changing of gear. And yet at the same time, it's funny because not that many political parties seem to be aware of really what the data is showing. And really, I think just walking through the streets of Vancouver, that there is really, I think, this kind of maturation of the city and which party can offer the kind of policies towards meeting that maturation of the city.
Mario.
It's a complicated matter for the voters. I think if you're somebody who's worried about housing because you want to get into the market, if you're somebody who's renting and wants to become a homeowner or buy a condo or whatever you can afford, you might go by the number of units that are being promised. And this goes against the realities of the market in that sense. You know, if somebody says 100,000 units, somebody else says 200,000 units, it's still going to be a complicated matter to explain after the fact. And to me, this is one of the crucial elements of the difficulties that the campaigns are having connecting on this file. Team has been very adamant from the get-go that they don't believe that this is something that needs to be done just by building more. And they do have a base of support, particularly from residents who aren't thrilled with the idea of their neighborhoods changing because of zoning regulations. And those are the people who show up and cast ballots. I think there's an interesting dichotomy there as far as the emphasis that some campaigns are putting on the youth vote, particularly one city, also Progress Vancouver, where all of the discussions related to the nightlife of the city and having this sort of captain, again, we go with the captains, who is going to be handling the nightlife. It might make sense, but it's not going to be enough to motivate the young voter who maybe doesn't even know that they're also voting for council and for school board. So as long as you have that core base of support, that could be the defining factor in the election. If you have the former NPA voter who is disenchanted with what the party has become, who isn't particularly thrilled with Ken Sim going through team, and that over 55 voter could actually decide the election, maybe not necessarily win it for Pauline, but certainly take a lot of votes that conceivably would have gone to another center-right party.
Right. And then within that split, does that enough create enough big enough split for Kennedy Stewart to take the mayoralty? But of course, the flip side is that, yes, you may become mayor, but who will you, which kind of council are you going to be working with?
Well, like, this is the most complicated issue for them as well. You know, the fact that you could have a split in the vote. I think one of the things that benefited the Greens the last time was the absence of any candidates running with Kennedy Stewart or with Shauna Sylvester. Now you have all of the mayoral candidates running with a team, and that makes it more complicated for the Greens to be the first vote for a lot of progressive voters. So you wind up in the situation that we had before with Adrian Carr, where she gets the residual vote from people who want to vote for a slate. So it could be a very different election for the Greens, because all of the candidates who are running for mayor are running with three or four different people, in some cases, six or seven.
Indeed. I mean, one can very much talk about, you know, there are as many splits here as there are in a Dairy Queen. And I think that this is really, I think, one of the kind of major, I think, interesting aspects of both the council race and the mayoralty race.
Now, Andy, of course, this week, you were like a kid in an ice cream parlor.
Absolutely.
You're the Duke of Data, because there was more census data that came from last year's census, this time a release on home ownership. Tell us how this trend could affect the election.
Well, that's the most interesting thing is that, well, if anything, trends continued on. That it was very much the story of how Vancouver has been a city of renters since 1971, that it isn't actually something that is new. It's actually since 1971, the majority of households in the city of Vancouver are renters. Now, one of the biggest challenges, of course, that we may be a city of renters, but we're not necessarily a city for renters. And I think that that is, I think, one of the kind of bigger challenges for this particular council, but then also having those renters come out to vote. As much as I think Mario has really identified the youth vote, there's also the challenges of getting renters to come out to vote. And I mean, the thing is that this is also capturing really the national trends, is that we've actually seen a decline in home ownership in Canada overall. So it kind of touches upon that. But of course, this being Vancouver, we actually had a slight increase in home ownership, that we're still a majority renter city, but yet we actually saw a 1 point increase in terms of home ownership. So, you know, it kind of couples to the various kind of complexities of the census. But then, of course, I think what's really interesting is to actually, in one way, see a decline in terms of households in core housing need, that there was actually about a 7% decline in terms of households that were in core housing need. But what's interesting is not to be captured by the changes in percent, but looking at raw numbers. Because when you look at the raw numbers of people of households in core housing need, you actually see a double digit increase. You actually see about a 12% increase. So there may by percentage be less, but there's a lot more of people in core housing need. And that is core housing need being defined by paying either or 30% of your income to rent, you're living in a unit that's too small, or in poor repair.
Like BC's 2020 provincial election and the 2021 federal election, Vancouver will feature mail-in ballots. The pandemic is not over, and this is a different way of people voting.
It might actually be a little bit easier for people. Every time I voted in municipal elections, you have somebody who's struggling with the ballot. You have somebody who's asking their for a significant other, how many votes do we get for Blackboard? It can be quite daunting, even for people who have voted before. It also allows people to look at some platforms from the comfort of their home. I mean, it's a little bit different from the previous examples that we have of voting by mail. I think it's probably more akin to what we saw in the Metro Vancouver Transit and Transportation plebiscite a few years ago, where the fact that the ballot was coming to your home also introduced a bias. You know, I remember at the time conducting a survey where people said, the ballot is arriving along with all of my taxes, along with all of my credit cards. You know, I don't want to pay more for this tax. So you introduce a bias by mailing your ballot. How is this going to work in a municipal election? Is this going to be enticing people to learn more about what is happening and maybe Google the names of some of the candidates or and some of the parties? Or are you bound to have your classic voter who always goes with the slate of candidates and just mails the ballot back? So it's tough to tell whether this is going to be benefiting anybody. As long as people follow the rules, you know, we could still have a lot of confusion with the ballot, even if you have everything in place and the three or four envelopes that you require to send it back.
Right. I mean, what's interesting is about 30% of votes occurred not on voting day. And that really, I think, talks to you about how campaigning is really, really important. And that idea that it's not only voting day, but then it's the fact that 30% of votes come in outside of voting, whether it's by mail or by advance polls, that I think it really covers that, particularly when it comes to a tight race, which I think that this election for mayor and council looks like it's going to be a tight race, that it may very well be a photo finish. And really how much vote by mail as well as advance voting will affect who's going to occupy council chambers.
There are all candidates meetings, but not all candidates are showing up at the meetings. Frontrunners Kennedy Stewart and Ken Sim have been no-shows for debates. Are there too many small debates, not enough big debates, or is it just enough? Should there be an independent debate commission?
I think it's absolutely necessary. You know, part of the problem that I see is the insistence in minor fringy candidates to be included in these debates. And you have people who line up outside of the debate venues with placards and upset about things and hurling obscenities at the organizers because they weren't invited. A city like Winnipeg, for instance, you require 250 signatures to get on the ballot.
Yeah.
This is something that four candidates for mayor in 2018 were unable to do as far as votes. So you have people who receive fewer than 250 votes saying, I want to do this again and I want my voice to be heard and this is part of democracy. It places a very complicated scenario in front of the organizers. Do I invite everybody? Do I give all 15 a chance to say what they have to say? And it makes it even more difficult for people to know what is happening. So point one for me is we need to raise the bar. You can't have all of these candidates running because they think it's something that they want to do. But also, it's difficult for candidates themselves to look at the calendar and say, We have 17 community associations that want us, and they want us to be there for 2 hours. And maybe I don't like who the moderators are, and I don't think this is a safe venue for me, or I don't want to do this. If we had some sort of organized commission, which allowed people to say, okay, we'll do these 3 debates and we're going to talk to the broadcasters. And this is also complicated because you don't have a television network that is willing to say, I'm going to have this from 6 to 8, knowing that half of your audience in Metro Vancouver doesn't care about the mayoral election. It used to be easier with Shaw. We had those debates. Bob, you moderated some of them. You know, it's an important situation that we no longer have as far as having a specific venue electronically where you could do this. And it's difficult for candidates, whether you're the front runner or not, to say, I'm going to spend the next 5 nights talking and rehashing the same questions with different groups of people, because I might be better off knocking on doors.
That all being said, I'd like to highlight the event that the Vancouver Public Space Network with the city program at SFU and the School of Architecture and Landscape Architecture is having with Last Candidate Standing, that will be featuring all the candidates in a debate, in a battle royale, if you will, the Thunder Dome, that is going to be on Saturday, October 1st at Robson Square UBC. So at UBC Robson Square. So come on over, and I think you'll see this. I think the guts of democracy come forward.
Speaking of reality shows, the draw for the ballot order happened September 16th. Kennedy Stewart and Colleen Hardwick, they are in the top four. Ken Sim and Mark Marison are the bottom two. Who benefits? Who suffers?
Well, I don't think it's going to make much of a difference. One of the things that is really fascinating for me is the ability of the candidates to list the party name next to their name. And, you know, we talked about whether you want your names listed in different alphabets or what have you.
Different languages.
Exactly. But the what is crucial here is, if you want to vote for a slate, it's a lot easier to find those candidates. If you're somebody who wants to vote for Progress Vancouver and all of their candidates, it's going to be a little bit easier to find them than if they're listed alphabetically or if you list them by party. I don't think it's going to make much of a difference. People who were on the cusp of being elected, and I'm thinking about Michael Geller, who I've had this discussion with many times, believe that, you know, the fact that it's alphabetical certainly helps. And, you know, I've been approached a couple of times to run because of my last name.
I have not, incidentally. I just want to point that out. I have not.
And you would be far better qualified for the job than me, but, you know, tough luck. You're on the bottom of the alphabet, or at least
the curse of Yan.
it's quite amazing in the sense of people will look at something and say, this is going to be important. It'll be easier to find. One thing that we could have, and this is something that happens in our democracies, is you list it by number. So you have your number of candidates, and your candidate after the draw is candidate number 7. And you knock on doors and go, vote for candidate number 7, number 7 for mayor, number 14 for whatever. It's a little bit easier to do it that way if you're going to do a draw. But we haven't seen anybody trying to discuss this in that fashion. And I think it's ultimately about the name recognition of the candidates, particularly those for mayor, and how that trickles down to the rest of the ballot.
Right. The question is the halo effect. Like, is there going to be a halo effect for the candidates in mayor, for mayor, to down to their parties? But then, of course, you know, what's going to be interesting is then we also see the Greens, who don't have a mayoral candidate. And will that come into an effect? But then I think it's going into really the idea of slate voting and really how much slate voting will really be what's going to drive how people are going to vote. I was starting to do a kind of document map to kind of take the last year, the last elections kind of ballot, and kind of map out where the hotspots were and kind of see if that ever, that made much of a difference. And it didn't really seem to come out as, you know, if you were low top to the higher top of the ballot, you got more votes versus the others, that, you know, it was very clear that it was your affiliations, your particular party, that particular slate really got you perhaps those votes, as opposed to your location specifically on the ballot. Although I have to admit, with a last name like Yan, this type of system kind of works for me.
The bottom of the city council ballot includes two from Progress Vancouver and Morning Lee of the NPA at the very bottom. When John Cooper was the NPA candidate for mayor, his priorities included cleaning up Falls Creek. Cooper was concerned about raw sewage polluting our waterways. Real estate agent Morning Lee was added to the NPA ticket after Cooper's departure. Lee made news for joking about how landlords should flush out bad tenants. In a Mandarin video on YouTube from 2021, Lee jokingly suggested that landlords take a shit in a tenant's toilet. It garnered media attention and criticism from opponents in ABC Vancouver. Lee reacted to a story by reporter Graham Wood by filing a handwritten, self-represented defamation lawsuit against publisher Glacier Media. None of the allegations in the lawsuit has been proven in court, and Glacier has not filed a response. Full disclosure, both Mario and I are contributors to Glacier Media newspapers and websites. This podcast is independent. I learned of the lawsuit via CKNW talk show host Jazz Johal's Twitter feed.
What do you think of this latest embarrassment for the NPA? That here you have a pretty solid story, well-reported story about what one candidate said, and how also his justification for it in the story was that it was a joke.
Well, I think Morning Lee definitely needs a computer printer. That you wonder if the NPA stands for the No Printer Association. That you got to look at who handwrites a court application these days. But I think that for me, it also, frankly, the entire affair. I think what's neat is actually how much more sophisticated Vancouver democracy has been. Is you can't hide under a language barrier, that it will come out. That I think that Vancouverites are civic minded, or perhaps the various parties, some parties are civic minded enough, and media are civic minded enough now to kind of be on the look in languages more than English, and bringing out stories that really reflect upon the various council members and those who are aspiring council members. And that this, I think, is, believe it or not, a healthy story. That Morning Lee, it kind of reflects his constitution, but that it's really a healthy story for Vancouver democracy, that really it is bringing out the stories in multiple languages and bringing them forward towards really judging their character and really should or should they not be in city council.
Mario.
I think Andy's absolutely right. It's important for the candidates to know that they're communicating in languages that will be understood. We've had this situation before in federal elections where the candidate for prime minister says something in French and it gets reported in English, or they say something in English and it gets reported in French. It's completely understandable in a place as multicultural as Vancouver to have something like this happening. A full disclosure as well, Glacier Media is my newspaper. They publish my columns. And my advice for Morning Lee would be to deal with autocorrect. It's very problematic to write something like this. I think it shows that, he's definitely dissatisfied with the fact that this is something that got reported. But it just doesn't really come across as something that is serious and that is actually representative of a party with the importance that the NPA used to have. Right. We're coming off a week where the big story was the NPA trying to be listed with Chinese names. And now we have a candidate from the NPA who says, you misquoted what I said because you don't actually speak Chinese the same way I did, or it was a joke, or whatever it is that they're going to allege that happened. But the fact of the matter is, this is something that was said, and welcome to politics. Everything and anything you said and is online can and will be used against you.
And that's it for MMA time this week. Mac and Mario and Andy. Thanks again to Mario Canseco of Research Co. and Andy Yan of the Simon Fraser University City Program for being guests on the Breaker.News podcast.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. In the Taiwan news, China blockade would be act of war. Taiwan would not surrender, official says. The senior Taiwanese security official, speaking on condition of anonymity, said China's drills after the Pelosi visit had shown what might happen in case the worst came to the worst, and focused thought on how Taiwan would react. The official said Taipei did not rule out the possibility of Beijing launching large-scale military exercises near Taiwan next year when the island gears up for a presidential election in early 2024. In Kyoto news, Toyota to end auto output in Russia over war-induced supply crunch. Toyota, which halted operations at its plant in St. Petersburg in March due to supply chain disruptions, is the first major Japanese automaker to announce its exit from vehicle manufacturing in Russia. Nissan Motor Company, another Japanese automaker, recently decided to extend its suspension of its plant in St. Petersburg for 3 months until late December. The plant had been set to resume by the end of September. In Hong Kong Free Press, head of Hong Kong journalist group Ronson Chan granted bail with no travel restrictions ahead of a six-month UK stint. The chairman of the Hong Kong Journalist Association is scheduled to leave Hong Kong next week to pursue a six-month fellowship at Oxford University. Ronson Chan has been granted bail after pleading not guilty to obstructing police officers. Chan was arrested on September 7th while reporting on a homeowners committee meeting for online outlet Channel C. Police accused him of not presenting identification.
That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest. In the Oregonian, legislature approves funds to expedite environmental reviews for chip industry in party line vote. A bipartisan task force of Oregon business and government leaders reported last month that three large chip makers are considering multi-billion dollar investments in Oregon. The task force warned that a shortage of industrial land in the Portland area and a cumbersome regulatory climate could derail those projects. The vote was 12-7, strictly on party lines, as Republicans lamented Oregon's overall pace of environmental review and objected to special treatment for any one industry. On King 5, Billingham Public Schools investigation confirms football hazing activity at Sehome High School. The district says an investigation found serious, confirmed hazing. As a result, the school's football team had to forfeit last week's game. A study led by University of Maine researchers found 47% of students have experienced hazing before college. Billingham Public Schools has an anonymous tip line. The district encourages students who believe they have been the victim of harassment, intimidation, or bullying to report it. On Czech News, Pamela Anderson renovates Ladysmith property in new HGTV Canada series. Pamela's Garden of Eden, a new 8-episode reality series premiering November 3rd, follows Anderson as she renovates her expansive 6-acre waterfront property in Ladysmith. She purchased the property from her grandmother 25 years ago. Earlier this year, Ladysmith Town Council allowed Anderson to build a 140-square-meter private dock in the harbor adjacent to her property.
That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Don't matter what color you are.
The virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to
Dr. Shalina Babul of BC Children's Hospital, who developed the Concussion Awareness Training Tool. This is Concussion Awareness Week in BC. Know the signs of brain injury? Know what you can do. Go to cattonline.com.
You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca.
That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of September 25th, 2022. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 25th of September in 1974, the first ulnar collateral ligament replacement surgery? It's better known as Tommy John surgery, named after the pitcher, but it's not named after the Los Angeles Dodgers specialist Dr. Frank Job, who developed it. Now you know. Send me your feedback, send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit TheBreaker.News on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/TheBreakerNews. That's P-A-T, reon.com/thebreakernews.
Until next week.